Can the European Union defend itself? Its leader says the bloc should increase its military capabilities and not rely so much on US-led NATO. But what's holding it back from achieving that goal? This is Inside Story. Hello there and welcome to the programme. I'm Nastasia Tay. Now, many European leaders have long pushed for a bigger military role, one that's independent of the US-led NATO alliance. The need for this increased military capability was recently made clear during the chaotic evacuations from Kabul airport. European nations had to rely almost entirely on the United States. Now, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen says the bloc needs the political will to stand on its own. She says the EU should be able to deploy a military force without relying on the US or NATO. But many in Europe have strongly rejected the idea of an active European military force, while others say the time has come for Europe to increase its military presence.
That our European Union is a unique security provider. There will be missions where NATO or the United Nations will not be present, but where Europe should be. You can have the most advanced forces in the world, but if you're never prepared to use them, of what use are they? What has held us back until now is not just a shortfall of capacity, it is the lack of political will.
Well, the NATO Secretary General warned earlier this month an EU defence force should not stretch NATO resources. Jens Stoltenberg said, "We welcome more EU efforts on defence, but that cannot replace NATO. It should not duplicate NATO because we have one set of forces and we have scarce resources." Well, earlier this month, EU ministers debated creating a 5,000-troop force to deploy during emergencies. But that plan faces opposition from some EU countries that are also members of NATO, particularly those bordering Russia. In 2007, so-called battle groups of 1,500 soldiers drawn from each member state were created but never actually used. Low defence spending among European countries is seen as a major obstacle to the continent's military independence. European NATO members spent 1.64% of their GDP on military expenditure last year. That's well below the alliance's 2% target. Now, Germany and France, though, are amongst the biggest spenders. They both increased their military budgets last year. Well, let's bring in our guests now. In Brussels, we have Teresa Fallon, the director of the Centre for Russia-Europe-Asia Studies. In Washington, D.C., David DeRoche, associate professor at the National Defence University and also a former NATO operations director at the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Also in Brussels, Nicholas White, an international affairs strategist and senior director for global solutions at APCO Worldwide. Thank you all for joining us and welcome to the programme. I do want to start with the practicalities here. I feel they're very important, really just how realistic this all is. So this obviously isn't a new idea, and it's been debated and discussed so much that we get to the point where some member states actually roll their eyes every time it comes up. So, David, what's actually stopped the EU from establishing a military force so far?
Well, I have to disagree with Ms. Franca. It's a lack of capacity. Look, you know, I came back from a NATO summit in 2006, and my son met me at the airport. He was 4 years old. And in the course of talking, he said, "I'm going to grow a beard." And I said, "Oh, good for you, kid. It's going to take a lot of time and determination." And then as I drove home, I realized that was kind of like what I had heard about European strategic autonomy on the trip. People have been talking about it for a very long time, but they've never done anything. And when they try to do something, they give it over to their militaries, which propose headquarters. You know, European battle group is a great idea, but they didn't create infantry battalions. They created a headquarters. That means, you know, the staff that does the staff work on this creates a lot of jobs for colonels and majors and generals. Those are very expensive. They're popular because they're jobs for senior officers. But, you know, a general is the equivalent of an infantry squad. And so what you get are you're draining precious resources out of the same shrinking pool of defense things, and you're creating duplicative headquarters that are commanding the same three infantry battalions. So, you know, I mean, it's a good idea, but if it would have been done, it would have been done already, and it's going to take a long time if people decide to do it.
Well, surely this is all going to take a huge amount of resources as well as building the existing capacity. I'm curious, Teresa, because I could see you nodding there. You, I believe, were also part of the strategic advisors group to NATO. Now, if you're the EU, why not just actually contribute more to NATO? Or if NATO is so irrelevant, why does NATO exist at all?
Well, that's another issue that has been long discussed, having a strengthened European pillar within NATO so that there wouldn't be duplication. And that's a key issue. And I think right now we had the State of the Union address yesterday, which you had some tape of Ursula von der Leyen, but she didn't mention in her speech strategic autonomy. So I think that's a really important point to notice what wasn't said. It seems like France is pretty much very loud about the strategic autonomy debate. And then in addition to that, we see this big Indo-Pacific announcement made today. Everyone had been waiting for it for such a long time, and that was kind of undercut by the US, UK, Australia, AUKUS new strategic partnership. So I think that Europe is kind of reeling right now, and they're not sure what they're going to do. They've had a year where Brexit, you know, Brexit has left. The UK was one of the biggest defense providers, and they were trying to think of a way for the EU and UK to continue to work together. But because of what just happened, it's clear that the UK is working far more closely with the US and Australia. So I think the EU is kind of reeling from that as well. And today at the conference, much touted European Indo-Pacific strategy, all of the questions, all of them, were about the new strategic AUKUS, the Australia-UK US. So it seems that they're pygmies on the international stage when it comes to defense issues.
Teresa, I do want to dig into some of the Indo-Pacific stuff in just a moment. There's plenty to discuss there. But Nicholas, I want to bring you in here because we're talking about EU political will, not just in terms of finding the money to do all of this, but also in terms of spending it on the right things and also dealing with the whole NATO issue. So in your mind, Nicholas, what's actually holding this all up?
There are a couple of things. One of them has been mentioned by both my colleagues already, which is the fear of duplication between the resources already going into NATO and the resources that might go into the EU. I'm a little bit sceptical about this, to be honest, because actually this is these are resources that are going to be used one way or the other anyway. And I'm not sure it makes such a big difference which hat the people are wearing when they're under a particular undertaking a particular mission. But we mustn't forget that there's another strand within the EU as well, which is those countries that are not members of NATO, Ireland, Sweden, Finland, Malta, Cyprus. These are not big EU member states, but at the same time, the EU is a creature of consensus. And it's quite difficult to build a defence structure that will simultaneously satisfy those like France who want to see a strong European defence and those whose national approach has been a bit more cautious and perhaps a bit more UN focused. That, and then the other issue, and again, you've mentioned that France is very keen on this. Germany is less keen. And Germany, of course, has an election very, very soon. The German government that emerges from that election is going to have a very important viewpoint. And Germany has historically been very reluctant to make any moves that are too strong in the military domain for perfectly understandable historical reasons. And I think a combination of German reluctance, failure to convince the neutrals, and fear of duplication with NATO have been the reasons that we have not seen this progress since David told his four-year-old son about growing a beard. Your son must now be 19, by the way, David. I wonder if he's tried yet. Yep.
And he has a beard.
Well, we'll see if the EU manages to get a beard. I do want to ask you all about the timing of this, right? Because as you just alluded to there, Nicholas, there are not just one crucial election in Germany, but also very crucial elections in France. And so, well, both Germany and France were the proponents of this idea to begin with, and clearly the French are much more keen on it right now. And I see that Macron is the person who's supposed to be chairing this EU defence summit early next year. That's a nice opportunity for him to be quite prominent and flex some muscle. So, Teresa, let me ask you then, is there the political will for this? Some member states, as we've been hearing, obviously not very keen.
Well, that's the key question. Is there a political will? We saw that France left Afghanistan 6 years ago. They're also preparing to leave the Sahel, which will give an opportunity for Russia to come in there. And so they are leaving the stage. And the fact that Macron infamously called NATO brain dead hasn't been missed by many analysts. And after the NATO summit, the communique, which every T, every I is carefully vetted beforehand, there are no surprises in any of that. Macron said, I never, and there, it was the first time they really mentioned China several times in a communique. So we saw that Macron afterwards said, I never saw China in the North Atlantic. So it was kind of a strange comment to make. And I think that there's questions about the reliability of some of these partners. We saw at the Munich Security Conference, Joe Biden, who has always been attending this, actually attended the first time as president. It was done virtually. But his speech wasn't really very warmly received. At least that was the impression of many analysts. And both Macron and Merkel said, we do not want to join any sort of counterbalancing democratic force against China. So I think that the newest developments kind of show that, well, all right, if you're not with us, that's fine. You've made your choice. At the same time, we see China kind of almost punishing Germany. Germany has, under Merkel, has been very cautious to balance values and interests. And they, first time in 20 years, they sent the Bayern, a German frigate, to the South China Sea region. And China asked them to come visit Shanghai. Later, they turned the tables and said, you can't come to Shanghai. This was announced as well yesterday. So it was kind of the seismic shift in Brussels, all of these things coming together all at once. And that in many respects, it was to humiliate Germany. And Angela Merkel has been a huge friend and partner of Xi Jinping. So it was interesting timing. And this kind of China narrative, it will be very difficult, I think, for Europe to continue down this kind of road of carefully cultivated, sitting on the fence and avoid making decisions, because in many respects, it's China that's making them make decisions. And clearly, political will is lacking.
Well, it's really interesting, this whole idea of pushing back against China, because we heard a lot more of that than we have in the past from von der Leyen in her speech yesterday. I mean, she talked about pushing back on or banning products produced by forced labor. That's obviously in relation to what's happening in Xinjiang, the need for independence when it comes to producing semiconductors and microchips within the EU, really trying to take a step back from the Indo-Pacific. David, we've obviously seen a US realignment here of their strategic priorities towards the Indo-Pacific. I mean, the submarine deal with the UK and US, a case in point. Do you think that the US and EU share a common view of the world now?
Well, it's converging. I mean, you know, there's always some friction. I mean, you know, in a large part of the European Bien Pensant community, the European Union has replaced Christianity as the religion of choice. And so there's a lot of decisions made for the European Union that, quite frankly, don't really comport with a strict definition of national interest. There seems to be this idea that everything NATO has, the European Union has to have, perhaps better. But that being aside, most of what the U.S. Wants out of Europe in confronting China is not really military, because we recognize there's a lack of capacity, and the limited capacity could be best spent in defending against Russia and, you know, possibly mass migration from the south, things like that. It's civil. What we're concerned about are things like having Chinese infrastructure and backdoors hardwired into their electric backbone, stuff like that. And the European Union can deal with that. So I think that there will be cordial, helpful, and developing relations with the EU on the security issue, but it won't be hard security issue of tanks, ships, airplanes. It'll be more things like this sort of broad band of Chinese Communist Party capture of economic sectors and key infrastructure sectors in Europe.
So we are going to be getting more details, I believe, this week about the EU's Indo-Pacific strategy, but it does feel like the temperature is rising there. And I know the EU is already planning to launch this so-called Global Gateway Initiative to really compete with China's Belt and Road Initiative. Nicholas, in your mind, is there a new Cold War brewing here? And what does that then mean for EU security?
And China is not a hard security threat to the EU or to EU interests. So I think we should be careful to separate these things out. For America, it's a bit different, because America has strong defense commitments in that part of the world to Japan and even more importantly to Taiwan. But for Europe, there is still a threat from China. And that's seen very clearly. I thought von der Leyen's best line in her speech yesterday was that the EU should not be trapped into building wonderful roads that just go from a Chinese-owned mine to a Chinese-owned port in Africa or wherever. So I think it's seen as real. I mean, some in the EU would say defensively that actually they have loads of initiatives already, which added up together would make would be equivalent to the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative. That's not the public perception. I attended the China Eastern Europe Summit in Sofia 3 years ago, at which the Chinese Prime Minister astonished everybody by saying that China favours European integration and a strong European single currency, which I guess just shows that sometimes you can be nice to your, to the people who you are visiting. So I think it's a complex situation, but for Europe, it's not a hard security question in a way that it is for America. I think one of the things that is happening in Europe, and you've alluded to it a couple of times, is a quest for relevance and credibility. Mm. And, you know, we have the European Union, just picking up on something David said, that people want to put an EU flag on everything. The EU is under pressure, like all systems of government are, to deliver for the citizens, and one of the things that it feels it should be able to deliver better on than it is doing at the moment is physical hard security, and that's part of what's driving this conversation.
Sure. Well, let me bring in Teresa here then. I see you're agreeing with Nicholas. In terms of relevance of the EU, right, you need to have some kind of common policy. That's the whole idea of the EU, especially when it comes to security. And presumably that means that you need to have some common set of foreign policy interests. And when you're looking at the rest of the outside world, I mean, this seems fairly obvious. I know Spain's military official was saying exactly this just a couple of weeks ago, that creating a European army means having common foreign policy, that we all share the same interests. I mean, Teresa, is that even vaguely likely, given the EU's lack of ability to even put together a single asylum seeker policy for the EU?
Well, when you have 27 member states with diverging interests, it's usually always, you know, leading from the bottom. And as we saw in a tweet issued by AKK, Germany's defense minister, yesterday, her hashtag was coalitions of the willing. So I think everyone understands that there will never be unanimity within the EU on any of these issues, that NATO is definitely the organ that they need to work through, and that they will work through coalitions of the willing. For example, the EU is hamstrung by Hungary, which kind of stops everything that the EU wants to do towards China, or there are other countries with various interests who will block things. So it's almost impossible to get unanimity. So from that point of view, it's extremely difficult and unrealistic to think of it in any other way. In addition, they've brought over Stefano Sannini, who originally had worked at NATO. So there's an interesting tie. There are over 60 discussion groups between the EU and NATO. So I think that this is a rich area that can improve. And I think that there are many people working on various levels that want that. Politically, some in France like to have a different narrative. But I think what is clear is that it's not just burden sharing any longer with the U.S. and its allies, it's burden shifting. The U.S. is focusing more on the Indo-Pacific, and Europe is going to have to up their game in order to take care of their own neighborhood and their own security issues there. And it's not a question of going to China. China is coming to Europe. They have invested in over 10% of European ports. We've seen Russia-China maritime exercises in the Mediterranean, in the Baltic. We've seen live fire exercises with them off the coast of Kaliningrad, near Kaliningrad. So I think that, you know, Europe doesn't have this kind of lugubrious, you know, laying back and thinking China's far away. It's happening right here in their own neighborhood.
Well, you spoke there a little bit about the context of the U.S., well, pulling out and pulling back in certain parts of the world, particularly, obviously, in Afghanistan over the last few weeks. David, this was always a U.S.-led mission, though, that started with counterterrorism, became nation-building, really. The Europeans were always there because of NATO Article 5, out of solidarity with the U.S. So because this was always a Washington initiative, why is it that the EU feels quite so betrayed at the moment?
Well, it's a good question. I think it's because of the way in which the, you know, the withdrawal was announced. It was announced in the press. There wasn't really, you know, there was consultations on an eventual withdrawal, I think, but I don't think there was consultations on the way the time frame that the withdrawal would occur, that it occurred over the summer. That caught a lot of allies by surprise. And, you know, it really showed the allies they had the choice of withdrawing on the U.S. timetable or not withdrawing at all. And, you know, that's a moment of strategic vulnerability that was exposed pretty importantly. But, you know, we get these shocks to our partners, but they happen repeatedly, and then they're just sort of filed away. So if you look at the Libyan campaign, that was supposed to be a European-led operation, you know, where the Europeans do most of the work there, and the United States was to just provide, you know, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, air-to-air refueling, a few key capabilities. Within 2 weeks, the European capacity was exhausted. The United States was in the lead. And, you know, President Obama says that's the biggest mistake of his life was, first off, he described this role as leading from behind, which, you know, was ridiculed viciously in the United States. But secondly, you know, it showed the lack of European capacity for, you know, what was a very major security concern, you know, because of the threat of mass migration and all that. And unfortunately, you know, our European partners have never got down to building the basic capacity. They hand it over to the bureaucracy, which builds headquarters. And again, you know, more majors and colonels devising plans for the same three infantry battalions.
Well, now von der Leyen is saying she wants an expeditionary force. And I've been wondering what these troops are actually meant to be doing. Something really struck me in her speech. She said there will be missions where NATO or the UN will not be present, but where the EU should be. On the ground, our soldiers work side by side with police officers, lawyers, doctors, humanitarian workers, human rights defenders, teachers, engineers. We can combine military and civilian along with diplomacy and development, and we have a long history in building and protecting peace. Nicholas, that sounds an awful lot like nation building to me. I see they've also launched this European peace facility to provide weapons and training to non-European military forces around the world. Is the EU, do you think, wanting to take on a more interventionist role here?
The EU has always been into nation building. Let's be clear about this. And this is the whole point of the original 1958 treaty, was to support state structures among the six countries that originally joined. And if you look at what the EU has been doing in terms of development, and I mean, you know, colleagues have been rightly critical of the EU's level of military ambition. Let's not forget that there have been a number of moderately successful, if rather small, military security missions. And the place where this has been most active most recently is Africa, and particularly West Africa and Sub-Saharan Central, North Central Africa. And, you know, if you look at the map, you can see why this is. And this also addresses the migration point. So I think we should be clear that there is maybe nobody wants to say it out loud, but this is the obvious place, much more so than Afghanistan, where European interests are at stake and American interests on the whole are not. We've had violent changes of government in two of those countries in the last couple of weeks, Chad and Guinea-Conakry. Several others are threats of instability, and all of this is direct feeding into the EU. So I think that answers your question. If I may say one other thing, I think we've concentrated a lot here on the obstacles towards creating an EU military. Those obstacles are real and serious. It's going to be a political process. It's going to be led by Macron and by others. It's also, and I was glad Theresa name-checked him, going to involve Stefano Sannino, who is one of the most gifted diplomats I've ever come across. So if there's somebody who can stitch all of these pieces together and turn it into something that looks more like the vision that von der Leyen put out in her speech yesterday, it's probably him. Maybe he's somebody you should get onto your show.
Nicholas, sorry to interrupt you. I want to bring Theresa in here just very briefly, because there was a lot of talk about the soul of the EU in von der Leyen's speech, especially around trying to come together around some kind of common interest. So, Theresa, let me give you the last word here. Do you see there being some kind of coalescence around this idea looking into the future?
The European soul. We'll know it when we see it. I think that there's a lot of skepticism, depending where you sit in Europe. For example, the Baltics. I was just at the Leonard Meri conference in Estonia. They're very skeptical about France guarding their interests. We saw, even with COVID-19, how the gates went up when it came to masks. So Italy was angry at France because they shut off masks for them. Do you think that they're going to trust them if they have any sort of need for military intervention? So I think that this is one of the things that will deeply divide Europe if this European army mm-hmm. continues this narrative, because you have the Baltics, you have Poland, who are very, very skeptical about these narratives. Indeed. And even Lithuania recently was, you know, kind of put on the naughty step by China and because for leaving the 17 plus one, and there was no EU solidarity or very, very little of it.
Clearly, and we're going to have to see if we do actually eventually find any EU solidarity around this issue. We're out of time, so I do want to say thank you to all of our guests, Teresa Fallon, David de Roche and Nicholas White, and you too, for watching. You can see this programme again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, do go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. We can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. From me, Anastasia Tay, and the whole team here. Bye for now.